Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with the G8 summit at Camp David and the announcement that the focus in Europe is now shifting away from austerity to growth. Thomas Ferguson joins us. He is a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking, and we will discuss Angela Merkel's apparent conversion in the face of a looming Greek default and the insolvency of Spain's banks. Then the policy director of the New America Foundation's Economic Growth Program, Michael Lynn, joins us. He is the author of a new book, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We will discuss the economic future of a country that became an industrial, financial, and military colossus that is now struggling to emerge from the Great Recession and could either become more of a plutocracy or rediscover its democracy. Then finally, we will look into efforts underway to save the whistleblower. Tom Devine, the author of The Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth, and the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, joins us. And Marcel Reed, the former president of ACORN in Washington, D.C., and one of the organizers of a conference that starts on Monday in the United States Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room, Whistleblower Conference on Civil and Human Rights, also joins us.
Joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He is a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He is the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And the G8 summit at Camp David concluded with an apparent conversion of Angela Merkel away from austerity towards growth. Clearly, behind the scenes, President Obama was basically pleading with her, since she appears to hold his political fate in her hands. Do you think that the deal, whatever it was that was made at Camp David, can last long enough until after the elections, or do you think Do you think the euro is going to unravel before then?
Okay, well, you got to decide which question you want to ask me. My take is there's probably no deal. I think there's probably not much more than a general understanding. And the U.S. doesn't have a sort of fundamental role in that, except to backstop it like that in the event we're needed. I mean, I think this is fundamentally a Eurozone story, and the basic bargaining is almost certainly between France and Germany. My take there is that both France and the Germans now have some incentive to do something. In that sense, I think they will move, but I don't think Obama had much to do with it. I think it's been clear for a couple of weeks that as the cost discussion about leaving the euro has gone up in Germany, they started with very low estimates, and now you get everybody shaking their hands and sort of saying, God, this could be a trillion euros and things like that. So Merkel got killed in the Nordrhein-Westfalen elections. And Hollande is running, a parliamentary election next month. So I don't think either one of them have very much reason to sort of want to keep the sort of European economy collapsing. In that sense, I think they probably will do much. I think they'll probably do relatively not enough. It has the look of any number of other European Union agreements to fix things up, which they talk, they do a little bit, and then 3 months later they're right back in the same situation. In this case, they can't be right back in the same situation because the Greek story, they really will have to move if they're lucky next month, if they're unlucky quickly, because after all, they have the equivalent of a bank run in Greece rolling right now. And the only way that cash is leaving the country without the place collapsing is effectively Greece is going more and more in debt to the European Central Bank, which is advancing them funds to sort of keep going. If that stops, then the game would be over. It hasn't stopped, and every day it goes on, the costs of stopping it rise. It's a really interesting conundrum.
Well, Well, that's been going on for 2 years, Thomas Ferguson. But
nothing like that. No.
Right, not as bad as it is now.
I agree with that. The bank run situation in Greece now is catastrophic.
Sure.
There's been a slow outflow of funds, but this is really a bad scene.
Well, it's also the Spanish banks are, for all intents and purposes, insolvent. And what could collapse the euro surely would be if these countries that feel that their euros are going to lose value start cashing them out. Then you have a run, don't you, if the Greeks start doing that?
Well, they're doing that. And now we'll see. As far as I can tell, you don't have a general run on the Spanish thing. You got reports of runs, some denials, and for sure, you can be sure that people will be moving money out. But it doesn't look catastrophic yet. If the Greeks, as long as they're sort of approaching, I believe the phrase is a point of inflection, they're clearly approaching a danger zone in Europe. But yeah, it could collapse. But on the other hand, what's happened so far is as people make their runs, the European Central Bank advances the money. When they won't refinance an individual bank, as they wouldn't do that in the case of four Greek banks this week, they give the money to the Greek Central Bank, which then advances the money to those four banks. I mean, thus far, the European Central Bank has been financing this, and as long as they do it, they can't blow the whole system apart. I mean, this basically boils down to how much bad debt does the European Central Bank want, potentially bad debt, does the European Central Bank want to pile up? And until the Germans say no on that, this game won't end. And thus far, despite a lot of talk, they haven't said no. I don't think they will do this earlier than the Greek election, which I in mid-June, and I kind of doubt they will do it then. I'm inclined to think opinion is shifting in Germany, but it could be an accident. Merkel obviously ruffled a lot of feathers in Greece just a couple of days ago when she may or may not have called up and suggested they turn their vote in next month into a definite referendum. The Greeks say she did, the Germans deny it. I rather doubt the Greeks made the story up.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. So just to summarize then, the G8 conference went at great pains to say they still want Greek in the Eurozone, but there is an election coming up, and if the new party, Syriza, under Tsipras wins, not that that's in the cards, although he's done better than anybody else, he's basically laid down a marker that he's not going to play by the rules anymore. So
they have, doesn't matter who wins, they have to renegotiate that deal. It's unbearable for the Greeks. But I think the only thing at issue here is whether the Greeks will give lip service to not changing the terms while the EU, in fact, then changes the terms. We're not there yet, but that's, I think, the sort of livable deal that may result out of this. But, it can certainly go wrong. It's not, if the Germans were too stiff-necked, then the whole thing could blow apart. But what I see when I look at the European Central Bank is they are continuing to finance these bank runs. And that tells me a lot.
So let's
making the decision now. In other words,
sure,
they have to wait till the June 17th. I think it's the 17th election.
So let's turn Thomas Ferguson to the situation in the United States, which of course is deeply tied, at least in terms of Obama, is deeply tied to the euro crisis. But we had our own little mini crisis, if you will, last week at J.P. Morgan Chase, where a repeat of a movie we've seen several times, a London branch was off the reservation and lost. And now it looks like they lost $5 billion. A French trader called the London Whale managed to lose $5 billion. And Jamie Dimon, of course, is now agreed to appear before the Senate Banking Committee under the chairmanship of Tim Johnson of South Dakota, which I believe is going to take place sometime next month. Tim Johnson is the chair of this committee that's supposed to be grilling Jamie Dimon, is the biggest recipient of JPMorgan Chase's money.
Well, yep, that's what I put out on Aldernet, and that's exactly true. I think the thing everybody needs to sort of focus on here is, first of all, note that the bank claimed to be just doing some hedges. Now, when you actually look at what the bank and other U.S. financial spokesmen say about U.S. exposure to Europe, they say, well, our gross exposure might be bad, but we've got most of this stuff hedged, and so our real net exposure is actually quite small. Now, what we just saw here is that the hedges they thought were, that what they claimed were hedges, were in fact no good at all. And that must inevitably raise questions about, what's the real state of U.S. exposure in the event of a European problem arising? If these hedges are bad, how many others are bad? Because it only takes a few of those hedges to go wrong over in Europe to bring down the whole system when everybody can't cover everybody else. And, that's what the bank regulators and the Congress need to be looking at. Now, it is a problem the nicest thing I can say about the Senate Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee there is that they were pretty bad on the Dodd-Frank revisions. That is to say, if you recall what happened, Senator Dodd had a sort of deathbed conversion. He was exiting Congress, and he actually, his draft of Dodd-Frank was a lot better than Frank's. But it was immediately rejected by his own panel, and Senator Johnson was one of those who were most vociferous in rejecting it. I mean, Johnson's got a really terrible regulatory record. And, he's the nicest thing you can say about him when you examine his record. I did up on the Alternet piece, which everybody can find with no trouble, an unsympathetic thing would say he's a stooge of the finance industry. It's worse that as it happens, by this wonderful coincidence, J.P. Morgan Chase is indeed his largest contributor for a long time. This is a real problem, frankly, the first thing you want to say here is, why are they waiting till next month? The problem is could be a big one in a matter of days. They actually are in the throes of a beginning of a European crisis. And for the U.S. Senate to just sit there and stall, which is what the senator is actually doing, is pretty outrageous. They need to get moving. This thing it has the look of a move to sort of calm everybody down and hope it will go away. But what we just discovered is that the hedges aren't so great. The question of whether U.S. banks are adequately covered in the case of a European collapse hinges crucially on all of the hedges they claim to have done, our offsets, especially the credit default swaps. If anybody can't pay those things in the whole chain can break. This is a real problem.
Well, Tom Ferguson, it's no accident that the senator who's been on J.P. Morgan's payroll for some time is now, of course, ironically conducting the hearing, and he's going to be the watchdog, although he's actually the lapdog. South Dakota, of course, was a state whose usury laws were changed in order to enable the credit card industry to start, in fact, both in South Dakota and Nevada, both states where they overturned usury laws, which essentially go back to the days of the Bible, and they're not just in the Christian religion as well. They're in the Islamic tradition. Isn't that the key to this?
Key is yes. If you mean it's not that they changed the laws, but that the cash is, let's say, comes from New York into the Dakotas. It's a problem.
Right, and it's 15. They can charge. They get the money for 2% from the Fed, and they charge it back to credit card customers at up to 35%. And Chase is the biggest credit card lender in the country.
Well, there's a whole infinity of rip-offs that banks are running on the whole population of the United States. That particular one, I think they get the money closer to zero from the Fed still. I mean, they're not paying 2% for money. Something like somewhere between 25 and 30% of bank profits are coming from credit card fees and things like that. They're still overcharging on all kinds of things, from bounce checks to debit cards and stuff. There is no end to this. And then, of course, you know, we're providing them with a big backup. Yeah, we have a serious problem here. And as far as I can tell, none of the regulators are doing very much about it. The Fed is equally they're supposed to be, and if you listen to the New York bankers, they are claiming that their business is being hurt by excessively tight regulation. Now, where was the Fed on these J.P. Morgan hedges? Just what were they doing? Simon Johnson said the other day in his blog, we need some answers to these questions. They need to call not only J.P. Morgan Chase people, but they need to call Bernanke and the Fed. And they need to sort of ask, what was the state of the bank examiners there in New York? It's a problem. I'm not trying to tell you that everything is wonderful. It's not.
Well, on that note, Tom Ferguson, there's no way that I think anybody that's really watching what's happening can say things are wonderful. The former Chancellor of the United Kingdom, Ken Clark, just said on Sky TV that Europe's banking system is in tatters, and warning that the UK is heavily exposed, and adding that cranky extremists getting elected in Greece could make things worse. And of course, we've
cranky extremists running the main countries of Europe. People
that's
bent
true.
On austerity. Exactly.
They're the real villains in the piece. I thank you for joining us, Tom.
Okay. Have a good one.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. And he has an article at Alternet, Senate Banking Chair Calls Jamie Dimon to Testify, but J.P. Morgan Chase is his biggest contributor. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the author of Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States.
Banks falling, presidents scratching his head, the economy is down, Wall Street about to lose their mind, up and down, gas prices up and down, nobody knows what to do. You know what we need, though?
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book just out is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And of course, in talking about the economic history of the United States, at this moment at the G8 summit in Camp David, the president, I imagine, with the rest of the world leaders, particularly the European leaders, is basically saying to Angela Merkel, save my political future by getting your act together. So at least in the political sense, America's economy is extremely vulnerable.
Well, that's right. The world is recovering from the aftermath of a colossal assets bubble in housing in the U.S. and other countries, most of which were trade deficit countries. The countries that ran the trade surpluses, like Germany in Europe, China and Japan, really need to do much more to sponsor consumption among their own people, because the American consumers are tapped out. The American consumers drove the world economy during this bubble economy by borrowing money in order to buy goods, many of them imports, from export countries like Germany and China. And unless the Chinese, as well as the Germans, the two leading export economies in the world, increase their domestic demand to make up for the shortfall of Americans' demand, now that Americans are trying to pay down their credit card bills and in some cases sell their houses, then you're going to have flat or negative global demand for years to come, and that will affect the United States as well as Asia and Europe.
So given what you've just told us, Michael Lind, why is the debate then about deficits and austerity here in the United States and not about creating demand? I mean, it sounds like we're afflicted by ideology, you know, outdated and non-applicable ideology, and, you know, we're out of step with economic literacy.
Well, what happened was there was a profound philosophical shift, not only in the United States, but in the Western world, that took place in the 1970s and 1980s, from the Great Depression and World War II all the way up until the 70s, the U.S. and the European countries more or less followed the tenets of demand-side economics, of which Keynesianism is a part. They were terrified that after World War II, the world would sink back into depression, and so they undertook reforms such as higher wages for workers, pro-unionization policies, social insurance to make sure that non-workers, like retired people, had plenty of income, simply to keep the whole mechanism of consumption going, because they understood that unless you have customers, then your businesses are not going to have, or that your businesses need customers, and the customers require income. What happened in the 1970s was the triumph of supply-side versions of economics. What we think of as supply-side economics, the Reagan-era theory that cutting taxes will lead to higher tax revenues, which has been discredited, that's simply one kind of supply-side economics. The so-called neoliberal Democrats, including Robert Rubin and Bill Clinton, have pushed their own democratic version of supply-side economics, which says we need to invest in the supply side of the economy in terms of human capital and technological R&D. And we don't need to worry that much about the demand side. So you had this situation for 20 or 30 years where the liberals as well as the conservatives were neglecting the demand side and focusing on the supply side. And in order to question this, you have to go against the orthodoxy not only of conservative Republicans and conservative Christian Democrats in Germany, but also against Tony Blair Labor Party people and Bill Clinton Democrats.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, the author of a new book just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So given that we're in this situation, I mean, I take it you're suggesting we're in a kind of no man's land at this point. Obviously, the mantra about cutting taxes and raising all boats has been discredited.
You know, but so has been the left's version of the supply side economics, which is sending everyone to college, right? Unless you have decent jobs with adequate wages, and with the adequate wages and the adequate benefits supporting mass consumption, then everyone can get a PhD, and it's not going to help the economy. So this broader supply-side consensus, with the left's emphasis on training and education, as well as the right's emphasis on tax cuts, I think has been discredited.
So when do we get away from discredited ideology into proffering something that actually works, which I take it is what you're trying to do in Land of Promise?
Well, it's somewhat discouraging if you look at history, because we've had three depressions, really, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. And let me just explain that you don't get depressions with mass unemployment in pre-modern agrarian societies. You may have famines, you know, the crops may fail, but it's only when you get industrial societies where there can be a mismatch between the goods produced and the customers who want the goods, leading to mass unemployment. So you begin to get these business cycles culminating in depressions and not just ordinary recessions, you know, once you get a machine economy. And the first one was from the 1870s to the 1890s. The second was the 1930s and 40s. And this is really a depression. We call it a recession. And its effects are moderated somewhat by the safeguards we assembled in the aftermath of the last depression, like unemployment insurance. But it really is a depression. And if you look at these two earlier experiences of depression, countries did not collaborate in order to boost demand. Instead, what they did was they engaged in a trade war and, in some cases, actual war. You had the scramble for Africa and the Middle East by the European empires trying to create markets for their own producers at the expense of other nations in the 1890s and 1900s. And then, of course, you had the rise of fascism and fascist and Nazi and Japanese imperialism in World War II. So there was a brief period following the crash of 2008 where the major countries agreed to have a joint stimulus of their economy. But since then, they've basically been engaged in a beggar-thy-neighbor attempt to export their own unemployment by running trade surpluses, by devaluing their currencies, by subsidizing their own industries. And it's just, it's hard for me to see where there will be a political base in these countries for the kind of combined international coordinated stimulus spending which we really need.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, the author of the new book, just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So what about, though, your book points out how technology-driven change leads to a growing misalignment between an innovative economy and anachronistic legal and political structures. The innovative economy we have now seems to me to be the death of capitalism, and that is the growing financialization of our economy. We no longer produce products, jobs, and wealth. We have Wall Street where they trade bits of paper, paper barrels of oil back and forth, rise the price of oil up by 40% and gouge the consumer, providing absolutely nothing except pain to an economy that's desperately needing to recover. I just wonder how long the extraction model of capitalism, the one that Mitt Romney is the poster boy, how long that's sustainable.
Well, I don't think it is sustainable, but you have to bear in mind that it is the equal and opposite, the complement of the other model of countries like Germany, Japan, and China. If you look at the bubble economy that lasts really from the 1980s up until 2008, the United States agreed, more or less implicitly, to be the consumer for the rest of the industrial world. And so Germany, China, and Japan, which if you add their economies together, equals that of the United States, ran perpetual merchandise trade surpluses, exporting both to the U.S., but also in the case of Germany, to its European neighbors. So the U.S. had a kind of very strange specialized capitalism where we specialized in borrowing money indirectly from the surplus economies like China, buying American government debt and also buying a private debt. So the U.S. specialized in consumption, fueled by debt. Mercantilist countries, that's the technical term for it, countries that try to run perpetual export surpluses like China, Germany, and Japan, specialized in government business strategies to prop up their export industries at the expense of the wages of their own people. And that was true in Germany as well as in China. In Germany, workers did not enjoy the benefits of economic growth. It's less unequal than the United States, but wages were suppressed in order to promote their export industries in these mercantilist countries. So if the U.S. model of financialized, debt-based consumption capitalism, and it's that model, by the way, which allowed this huge overgrowth of the financial sector, because if Americans hadn't been borrowing and paying interest charges, then the banking sector would be much smaller than it is. If the American financialized capitalism collapses, then so does the demand for this German, Japanese, Chinese, highly industrialized, over-industrialized, in fact. Because one of the problems is, on a global scale, not in the United States, we've lost a lot of industry. But on a global scale, there's too much industry compared to the people who can afford to buy its products. So thanks to government subsidization, particularly in China, global industry has been overbuilt, even while it's been declining in the United States. And since these two systems were parasitic and interlocked, each needed the other one in order to function, then when the American financialized, debt-driven economy crumbles, so does that of the other industrial countries, which was based on the opposite model, targeting the U.S. And similar countries with consumption-based capitalism.
Let me remind the audience again, if I may, that I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the author of the new book just out, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. So obviously the mantra that you have to cut taxes to stimulate the economy and that the wealthy, the 1%, are the job creators, that is discredited. The job creators are an affluent middle class who can buy products. You also said the other myth that has to be shattered as well is the kind of Bill Clinton neoliberal myth of getting everybody going to university. And I recall during the Republican primaries, Rick Santorum accused Obama of being a snob because he felt people should get an education. What are the ways that we can employ people? And I'm assuming that we're trapped in an economic system where people have to have wages in order to create demand and they have to buy products. And unless we all turn into hippies and live in a commune and get off corporate food and get off the corporate grid, what's the alternative?
Well, it's a real challenge because you're seeing, and this in the long term, there's going to be a shift out of manufacturing into service sector jobs, in particular personal service jobs that can't be outsourced for many low-skill Americans. As factories become more automated, even if we bring back some of the factories that have been lost to foreign trade practices, you're going to have increasingly automated production. And that's true of mining, it's true of agriculture. You're going to have a much more robotic economy. And so there will be jobs, but they will be in the areas of health and education and of amenities and recreation. If you think about it, Facebook is kind of a form of recreation, frankly. I mean, I don't think it adds a great deal to productivity, but it's entertainment. But so that's perfectly fine. As nations and as individuals get wealthier, they spend more and more on personal services, including dining out and tourism, and because the cost of appliances gets cheaper and cheaper, thanks to productivity growth. That's all quite natural. But the question is, if we're going to have a service sector majority, are they going to be a well-paid middle class, or are they going to be poorly paid working poor? And our whole policy of the last 20 or 30 years has been to crush unions, to allow inflation to eat away at the minimum wage, which would be $11 or $12 an hour now if it had been adjusted for inflation from the 60s. Cutting back on benefits. So the fact is, these things are within the power of particular countries to address, and different countries may address them differently. So one country may subsidize the wages of service sector workers. Another may require a living wage, you know, much higher minimum wage. A third may provide much more public services so that low-wage workers get subsidized goods, let's say, you know, free health care or free child care, that sort of thing. And it's a debate we should be having, but we're not having it because a lot of the progressives, so-called, as well as conservatives, have bought into this idea that wages and living standards are determined purely by markets. There's something called the free market out there, when in fact, whether your majority is paid well or not, has a great deal to do with the institutions of your country, including labor institutions and public policies.
But obviously, the disparity in wealth is stark and growing, and it's a global phenomenon in terms of the 1% as opposed to the 99%, at least in the industrial world. I guess it's always been that way in the third world. So I'm trying to figure out why it is that we can't have a... I mean, what is driving this? My understanding in many ways is that capital is the beneficiary of increased productivity, whereas labor is not, and that the household income and productivity used to track in parallel, and then starting with Ronald Reagan, they've started to diverge.
That's right, but it's not a result of technology. It's a result of institutions. So where they diverge in the United States... it's because of institutional reforms that took place in the U.S., but not necessarily in other industrial countries. So you get a private sector unionization collapses from about a third in the 1950s to less than 7% today. As I said, inflation eroded the minimum wage. You've had a transformation of corporate culture. Because of in the 1970s and 80s, corporate executives start getting stock options, which are supposed to align their interests with those of the company. In fact, they align the interests of corporate managers with the billionaire plutocratic class rather than their own workers. So if you look at countries like Canada and like Britain and like Germany, where those sorts of reforms did not take place, you get much less polarization and much less inequality. It does increase to some extent. I'm not denying that. But much of the inequality in the United States is not the result of inevitable technological factors. It has to do with rigged systems of corporate compensation. In the case of high-paid doctors and lawyers, it has to do with rigged licensing systems where the supply is artificially kept small to drive up fees. A lot of, one of the great frauds on the public is that the well-organized special interests in the United States and elites have essentially trashed the working class majority for a generation. And then when they're caught, they say, we didn't do it. The market did it. Globalization did it. Technology did it. Anybody but us. Because if you blame it on an impersonal global force, that means there's nothing you can do about it, which is what they want you to believe.
Well, now they're so in your face in the sense that, you know, with the Ryan budget, they're basically, the elites are basically saying, or at least the hirelings in the Congress are saying, oh, and Pete Peterson, who's funding a lot of this propaganda, saying, oh, you know, the middle class and the working people in this country have had it too good.
Yeah, that's right.
We've got to cut back on Social Security. Right. It's the only way we're going to deal with the deficit. You know, Medicare is, you know, et cetera. I mean, it's an amazing... Now, Michael Lind, in your book, the new book, Land of Promise and Economic History of the United States, you go back to the founding and to what seems to be a perennial struggle between Hamilton's and Jefferson's competing vision. How much is inequality in the DNA of the country? Because it certainly, to just a cursory look at the Civil War, it seemed like the South was about a kind of a plutocratic plantation economy and the North was about a more inclusive economy.
Well, that's true, but we shouldn't idealize the past too much. The United States was always very highly inegalitarian, and even in the Civil War, rich Northerners could pay for poor guys to be substitutes for their own rich kid sons, so they could sit out of the war. You could buy your way out of the draft, and you've had at least local and regional elites, North, South, and Midwest, have always had a very large share of the money. Really, the one period in American history when you get a compression of inequality, it's from the New Deal up until the 1970s. And you find a similar phenomenon in the rest of the industrial world. It wasn't limited to the United States. And it just had to do with, for one thing, you had universal suffrage. So that it's only after World War I, for example, in Britain, that you get a universal adult male voting. And it's only with the Civil Rights Revolution in the United States that you get a true universal suffrage in the United States in the 1960s and 70s. And so people simply vote for policies that will give them higher wages and more incomes and better benefits. And at the same time, the elites were frightened in the Western world by the rise of fascism and the attraction of communism in the 1930s and by World War II. And so you had a generation after World War II, even if they were otherwise fairly conservative, they weren't necessarily terribly enlightened, but they just thought for their own self-interest. They had to make sure you didn't have miserable people in the U.S. and in the Western countries. And I think what happened was you got a generation of wealthy people who came to age, and they simply didn't remember the Depression and World War II and fascism. They thought this was, you know, this they read about in the history books, or their parents or grandparents told them about it. And I think, frankly, they're committing suicide. They're committing political suicide, because I don't think there's a danger in the long run that you're going to have a plutocracy that can last for any amount of time, because plutocracies tend to be the most despised elites, right? You know, since they haven't gained their eminence by serving the country, by serving in the military, they don't have any particular religious distinction, you know, religion being one of the other bases of authority. They're not necessarily great benefactors of the arts. So all of the things that traditional elites do to promote their legitimacy, people who just make their money on Wall Street by having computer programs that arbitrage changes in currencies, you know, they're really fundamentally lacking in legitimacy. So the question is, at some point, there will be a backlash, and they'll be reined in. The problem, if you're a progressive, is the backlash may not take liberal and democratic forms, right? It can be some kind of illiberal populism of the right or of the left. And I think there's real danger of that. And you can see elements of it in Europe already, with this backlash against the technocratic pro-austerity elites. It's a healthy backlash, by the way. I mean, but you just want to make sure that it isn't channeled into international competition and into illiberal populism instead of into constructive, progressive forms.
And I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book just out is Land of Promise, an economic history of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the organizer of a whistleblowing conference taking place in Washington, D.C., along with the author of The Whistleblower's Survival Guide, a handbook to committing the truth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Devine and Marcel Reed. Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Office, which champions the rights of whistleblowers. During his 30 years at the Government Accountability Project, he represented or informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers to defend themselves against retaliation. And he's authored and co-authored numerous books, including Courage Without Martyrdom, The Whistleblower's Survival Guide, The Art of Anonymous Activism, and The Corporate Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth, which won the award as the International Business Book of the Year at the 2011 Frankfurt Book Fair. And also joining us is Marcel Reed, who is the whistleblower liaison for the Pacifica Foundation. And previously she served as president of ACORN in Washington, D.C., and served on a number of boards in the metro Washington, D.C. area, from health to housing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Devine and Marcel Reed.
Hello, Ian.
Thanks for having us.
And let me begin with Tom. Since you've written such the handbook for whistleblowers, why do whistleblowers do it? Because as much as there is legal protection, and I know the conference that you're taking place in Washington is designed to add to protection, and there are efforts to undermine what protection exists on Capitol Hill. But why do whistleblowers do it? Because more often than not, they end up being hurt, don't they?
that's the first question I ask potential whistleblowers who come to us. Why do you want to do this? Because it's a decision which is going to irrevocably change your life. It'll never be the same again. And consistently, the reason is they do it to be true to themselves. They have to do it, one person said, to look myself in the mirror. If they kept it to themselves, it would be they were part of the cover-up of something they knew was just completely indefensible, that violated their moral code of life. It would be like a cancer eating away at them inside, haunting them the rest of their lives. And even though it's whistleblowing often kind of analogizes the sound of professional suicide, committing the truth because you're treated like you committed a crime, they do it anyway because they got to live with themselves.
So the fact that you got Senators Charles Chuck Grassley, who supported whistleblowers, and Susan Collins, the sponsor of the original Whistleblower Protection Act, present at your hearing at the conference that's taking place Monday through Wednesday in the United States Senate. My understanding is, though, that an anonymous senator put a hold on efforts to improve or protect whistleblowers in a way that was not transparent and somewhat cowardly. Where does that stand, Marcel?
Well, right now we've had that lifted. There was actually a vote. When was the vote, Tom? I believe it was last.
It was last week, last Monday, the Senate unanimously.
So, Tom, who was the senator? Who was the
It was a joint staffer for two senators, Senator John Kyle, the number two Republican in the Senate, and Senator Jeff Sessions, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee for the Republicans. But what's particularly interesting is, thanks to public radio, we were able to get listeners to call in and help pressure and in the offices that did it came out of the closet, and they explained they didn't do it because they were opposed to the whistleblower rights. They did it as a professional courtesy at the request of the incoming House leadership. And this was December 2010, and those incoming Republican House leaders had just won an election based on being the party that was truly committed to fighting fraud, waste, and abuses of power by big government bureaucracies. And here it is that they get a Senate office after allowing the bill to, on the surface, be unanimously passed in the House of Representatives. They get a Senate office to put a secret hold, killing rights for the government workers who actually risk their careers for the same rhetoric that those politicians got elected on. And how do you like that?
Well, don't get me steamed up here. Let me ask Marcel Reed about we just witnessed on 60 Minutes two very courageous Air Force pilots who fly the F-22 Raptor, this plane that cost the taxpayer about $500 million a copy, if you can get your head around that. And they've lost a number of them, including their top pilot, because they can't. The oxygen supply is killing them and making them disoriented. And furthermore, there's something toxic about the air in general that they're breathing. And yet, in spite of this, the Air Force is trying to force the pilots to fly it. And these two pilots went on strike. They had the protection of a congressman under the whistleblower statute, and is that what it takes, Marcel? That you really have to have that kind of high profile, 60 Minutes cameras, and a congressman?
Absolutely, I believe in some on some occasions that doesn't protect you. That congressman was Congressman Adam Kinzinger. He is from Illinois. He is a Republican. And we actually have contacted him about receiving one of the awards that we'll be giving out called the Pillar Awards for those who have protected the First Amendment rights and the Fifth Estate, you know, those whistleblowers who have stood up to protect the taxpayers and citizenry in general here in the U.S. But of course, that's exactly what it takes. And even with that, you have no guarantee that these men will pay for it somewhere along the arc of their career. It may not be now, it may be 2 or 3 years from now, but they may well pay for this.
Well, let me ask Tom Devine, the author of The Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth. You're going to be at the this conference starting Monday through Wednesday in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing rooms. I know I've also talked to Ale Press, wrote the book Beautiful Souls, saying no, breaking ranks and heeding the voice of conscience in dark times. He's also going to be in attendance. What are you hoping to achieve in the next 3 days, Tom?
We're trying to, there's a lot of worthy objectives to this conference. And a big part of it is helping to get the No Fear Act, which is to enforce anti-discrimination laws for race, sex, and religious discrimination to start being genuine rights. The overall goal, I think, is so that the rights of people who are harassed at the workplace are worth the paper they're written on. Currently, they're not. My specific goal is helping to get the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act over the hump to finally get enacted into law after close to a half a dozen unanimous approvals that didn't mean anything because of these backroom procedural sabotages. And just to illustrate, this law, it's supposed to be free speech rights. The reality is they're a trap. Since 1994, when Congress last unanimously strengthened this law due to a lack of normal due process, that's the Achilles heel, due to the lack of normal due process, the track record is 3 wins and 220 losses for decisions on the merits when whistleblowers tried to assert their rights. In other words, if you act on your rights, you can spend many years, tens if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, and keep reliving the nightmare of retaliation, all to help hammer the final nail in your own professional coffin. I spent years of my life getting that law passed originally, and the way it was gutted and twisted and distorted by the power structure, that law is my professional baby, but it grew up to be Frankenstein. I warn people, don't act under the Whistleblower Protection Act unless you don't care about the outcome. You just want to confront your accusers. And this is the way it is for way, way, way too many of the rights protecting us as free citizens at the workplace.
So, in other words, the backroom players change the law to actually not to protect the courageous and innocent, but to actually put them in further jeopardy?
It's almost like a trap to lure people into exposing themselves as critics and then retaliate against them, and their legal rights are the way to finish them off. And there's just no excuse for that. And we have switched from Trojan horse rights to credible rights for the private sector, for corporate whistleblowers. There's been a legal revolution in corporate free speech rights, and now they actually can get away with committing the truth if they know what they're doing. But there's just no excuse why employees who are defending the citizens have second-class free speech rights compared to employees who are defending the shareholders. Congress, if they're serious, all these Republicans who say we're against big government, if they kill the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act again, that's just false advertising. They are shielding the abuses of big government.
Well, let me ask Marcel Reed, who's one of the organizers of this conference starting on Monday in the U.S. Capitol Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room, Whistleblower Conference on Civil and Human Rights. You've organized a very impressive coalition of people here, Marcel, but, you know, I have to tell you as a journalist, I rely on whistleblowers. I rely on people that have been inside the government and that it seems that only once you're out of government can you tell the truth. And of course, the courage of whistleblowers are that they're already in government witnessing wrongdoing, and risking their careers to let the public know. I don't understand why the entire press in this country doesn't understand the First Amendment's stake in this issue, because we as reporters rely on these people for sources and we're nothing without the stories that they bring and the courage that it takes for them to bring these stories to us.
Absolutely. And just to expand a little, if I may, Ian, on what Tom was just saying about the Whistleblower Enhancement Act, there's also two Democratic senators who have risked a great deal. One of them is currently leaving Congress. That is Jim Webb out of Virginia and Claire McCaskill out of Missouri. They have been staunch supporters of this, so that people understand that this cuts across a party line. Telling the truth should not be aligned with a single party. And I think the other thing that you asked me about why the press does not see this is I think that it really is some truth to that whole notion of corporate media. I know that, you know, in the last day or two, we've heard a few things that haven't been complimentary about this, even though it's being held at the Dirksen office building. When you have corporations tied too closely with media, you have to question whether or not that media is free to actually tell the whole story. And whistleblowing threatens any kind of cover, any kind of collusion. Whistleblowing threatens that, and I fully understand why the press doesn't cover them on occasion. And First Amendment rights are something that you'd think that the press would fight for, as Pacifica has so heartily over the years. But I'm noticing that that isn't as true as it should be.
Well, Marcel, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and also Tom Devine. Thank both of you, and maybe later in the week we can get a summary of what happened at this 3-day conference that starts on Monday in the United States Senate's Judiciary Committee hearing room. Again, Tom Devine is the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, which champions the rights of whistleblowers. During his 30 years of Government Accountability Project, he's represented informally helped over 5,000 whistleblowers to defend themselves against retaliation, and he has written the Whistleblower Survival Guide, a handbook for committing the truth. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
And Marcel is the whistleblower liaison for the Pacifica Foundation. Previously, she served as president of ACORN in Washington, D.C., and served on a number of boards in the metro Washington area, from health to housing. Thank you also, Marcel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.